The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Brought some fresh air into the room. It helps us. When I do teach, I teach in the afternoon, it tends to be, and I teach in a room we call our library. It's sandwiched between the kindergarten room and the first and second grade room, and they tend to like their rooms. It seems a little warmer than high school students need to have their rooms, and our room tends to get kind of warm in the afternoon. And all of our storm windows in the building come on and off at one time, and that time hasn't come yet. And it's a little hard to keep attention in the classroom when it gets warm in there, especially when you're a history teacher. It's a little difficult. English teachers have it made, I understand. Okay, the topic today is developing a context for character development. And we're going to start by defining some of the terms. There are three words here we're going to define. The one word is used twice in two different forms. We're going to start with the word develop. The word develop, as we're going to define it for our purposes today, is to create or to expand in a gradual manner. To create something, or if you already have it, to expand it, fill it out. But it definitely has the connotation of being done in a gradual way, step by step, layer upon layer. We are then, according to this topic, we are creating in a gradual way, we are expanding in a gradual way a context. The context is a certain situation or set of circumstances that has been artificially created. We are aiming to artificially create something in our classrooms, in our school, wherever we find ourselves instructing, a context. This context is supposed to help us develop character. And character, we're going to define that this afternoon in a very general way, as personal moral qualities that we would like to see come about in the lives of our students. So let's put this together again. We are creating in a gradual way a set of circumstances that will enable us to bring about personal moral qualities gradually in our students. Okay, so we're assuming already this isn't going to happen tomorrow. This isn't going to happen next period. This is going to happen over a long period of time. We're going to develop these things. Now, I found this topic to be a little bit difficult to get ready for. I kind of struggled with it for quite a while. It actually kind of scared me for a while, okay? Developing a context for character development. And then three targets that we're supposed to hit. We're supposed to talk about curriculum, we're supposed to talk about structure, and we're supposed to talk about methods. Now, the curriculum, that's what we use. That's the hard copy that's in front of us. That's the text, that's the workbook, the other materials that you bring into the classroom, present to the students or to the people you are teaching. That's your curriculum. The structure, that's the entire environment of the school. That's how I'm going to define it and use it today. The structure that you're functioning in as a teacher in XYZ school, the methods, that's a little more personal. That's you. How you are relating to the students, how you are relating material to the students. I want to give credit where credit is due. I wouldn't have been able to come up with some of the ideas that I am going to share today without a certain person's assistance. I have a person who is I might say my personal mentor in education. This person held the job that I now hold before I held it. This person is Kay Predmore. She has more years of experience in Christian education than I have years of existence. You have a question, you need to call Kay Predmore. She lives in Lititz, Pennsylvania. She's retired now from active participation in Christian education, but she does educational consulting. So if your school needs an evaluation, your school's facing a problem, there's a person to call. If you want her phone number, you can contact us at school and we'll be glad to put you in touch with her. She's a valuable resource and was a valuable resource to me for this topic. This afternoon, I'm going to focus in these three areas in very practical aspects, or at least as in, they're going to relate to the experience we have at school, things that we do at school. It's going to be kind of anecdotal. I worked as an administrator at Maranatha, and administrators see a lot of little pictures of situations in the school. It's said that administrators know enough about everything in the school to ask dumb questions about anything. And that's exactly how it is. We see little things, but these little things kind of build pictures in our minds and help us reinforce some principles. The roadmap that I'm going to lay out here is not something that we have attained or that I have attained as an individual. It is a goal, okay? It says here developing, development. Develop means to create or expand in a gradual manner. It's something we're aiming for, something we're striving toward. We do not claim to have achieved these things at school, but they are things that we're working toward. We're going to talk about a lot of different areas. We're going to hit on a lot of different things. I would like for you to pick out one thing that we hit on here this afternoon and explore it a little further on your own. Okay, I'm going to bring some things to you, throw a bunch of ideas out to you. I want you to latch on to one of them and say, in my school, where in my classroom, where I work, how can I take this and use it effectively? How can I study this idea a little bit further? How can I increase our progress in this area? How can we better develop character in the children or the young people that we're working with in this one area? Okay? There's a danger if we throw a lot of ideas out, you're going to look at those big ideas, big list of ideas, and do nothing about any particular one. So I'm asking you just be looking for one that fits you or that fits your classroom or that fits your school. These areas do kind of tend to overlap, so it was kind of hard sometimes to separate them out. Do I put this one in structure and do I put this one in method? They will tend to overlap, and you'll see that as we go along. We need to aim to develop character through the curriculum that we use at our school. We have choices when it comes to curriculum. We have a choice of selection of text. Now, you might say, well, no, I don't. I'm the teacher. I don't purchase text at this school. I have no say in the program that we use, in the product that I have to use with my students. That is not really true. When we order at our school, we hear from teachers. Teachers are like immovable objects. They get used to certain things. They are natured certain ways, and they let the people who buy, the people who do the purchasing, know what they like and what they don't like. Some of them will come and say, others will give those little grudges and errs along the way, and you will quickly figure out what they like and what they don't like. As a teacher, you do have some influence over the curriculum that's used in your school, and that influence should be used in a kind and in an equitable way. Perhaps some of you here are school board members or your administrators. You have a little greater role in choosing which types of curriculum you're going to use in your school. In our school, we use a variety of curriculums. We don't stick with any one publisher. We don't use exclusively Christian text. We don't use exclusively secular text. We use a mixture, kind of a hodgepodge that's developed over a number of years. You have a choice of using Christian text in your school. That's basically the two options I'm going to look at when I talk about using text. Christian text versus secular text. Using Christian text in your school, one advantage is that there are fewer objectionable elements to be dealt with in the material you want to present. Okay, you have a certain criteria. You have a certain goal in mind when you choose a textbook. You want to develop your young people into being something. You want the texts that are used in your school to be a help to that end, not a hindrance to that end. When you choose to use Christian text, you help yourself in that there are fewer things there that you have to weed out. There are fewer things that the teacher needs to either obscure or they need to draw attention to and point out the problems there, so they can focus more on what they intend to teach instead of spending their time excising things from the material. And that's an advantage with Christian text. Now, using Christian text also sometimes presents a dilemma, because we do not have text in every subject at every subject level that are written from our theological perspective. So we are forced to choose text, for example, history text. We're buying a new U.S. history text for next year, Lord willing, at our school. kind of looking at the text that's produced by Bob Jones University. Now, there are things in there that will be objectionable to us. Okay? We are non-resistant. They are not non-resistant. And that comes through in more than just a few ways. So there are fewer things to consider when you use Christian texts, but you still must consider different things that are problems from the publishing standpoint. Now, it is true sometimes that that which is close is more dangerous than that which is far away. We're using Christian texts in our school. That's all we use. That's all we buy. Our textbooks are safe for our children. That's not necessarily so. It's easier to be misled by something that sounds right, something that quotes scripture, something that refers to God, than it is to be misled by perhaps a science text that is openly evolutionary in outlook. The student can immediately see there are problems here. But then if there's something else that's written by Christians, published by Christians, it's kind of harder for the teacher maybe to even notice it and pick it out, and a lot of things kind of slide through and subtle influences enter the classroom that we did not intend. So that's something we need to consider. If we're looking to build character in our children, we have to carefully consider the text we're using. We're going to use Christian text. If we are, which ones are we using? What's dangerous even in the Christian text that we have? This last year we took on Bob Jones's Bible curriculum in grades 1 through 4. Is that right, Ms. Knoll? We only teach Bible 3 days a week in elementary and in high school also, and that curriculum is set up for use 5 days a week. So we can excise 40% of the lessons. We have to do that anyway. I believe one of the students' workbooks came. They're nice, attractive books. They come with a cover picture, a person who kind of represents a character quality or a theme. And one of them, I don't remember whether it was third and fourth grade or first and second grade, it was General Robert E. Lee on the cover. Is that what we want to set down in front of our students every day as something for them to grow up to be like? Robert E. Lee. Lots of admirable qualities there, characteristics. Do we want to set a military general in front of our students every day? We bought the text. We excise certain lessons that don't match our theological viewpoint, and we covered the picture of Robert E. Lee on the text. Just things that you have to consider when you buy Christian texts. Christian texts have an advantage in that they have a passive godly influence, or at least they should. I was studying a little bit this morning in Brandon's office, and I saw something on the shelf there. And it is an example. It was an Abeka grammar book, a teacher's text for Abeka. And we use the Abeka grammar in our high school, 7th grade through 12th grade. That is a way in which you can teach something like grammar with a passive Christian influence. I flipped through there and found a sentence. The sentence was, God created man in his own image. Okay, now you can be having all kinds of fun in grammar class diagramming sentences. Here's your subject, there's your verb, there's your direct object, there's your object of the preposition, there's your preposition, there's your object of the preposition. Doing those types of things, which you have to do that, don't you? You have to teach subjects, you have to teach verbs, you have to teach prepositions. But what did they choose for the sentence that the students are focusing on? God created man in his image. Notice something else too. The H in his is capitalized. We do that out of respect for God, respect for divinity. Here we're teaching grammar. We're teaching subjects and verbs. We're teaching diagramming. Yet at the same time, there's a passive influence that we're feeding into a child's mind. God created man in his own image. Capital H for his if you're talking about God. That's a passive influence. That's a benefit of using a Christian text. You get that. You do not get that in a secular text. On the other hand, you get things that you would rather excise from the book. We have a secular, we use a secular text for 5th and 6th grade math and examples about multiplying. If you buy 7 CDs from the group such and such, or you're buying 8 movie tickets and they cost such and such a piece. That's less than the best. You know, we're worried about the multiplication. And then we've got that little hindrance there. Do we really want to stand in front of the class and say, okay, Jonathan, if you're buying 7 movie tickets at, okay, we're causing problems for ourselves. Sometimes we have to use secular text. Our funding mechanism at school, how we buy text, we have to spend probably about 60% of our curriculum money on secular materials. Have to, no choice. But then we have to know what we're doing. We have to kind of be choosy and pick and choose. Secular text. Is there a value in using secular text? I believe there is. Secular text can provide a springboard for philosophical discussions. You're using a history text, and it's not written by a Christian publisher. You're in early history, perhaps ancient history. They use a date that's out of our frame of reference, millions of years ago. Okay? Now, we might be talking about dinosaurs or whatever we're talking about, but we can take a timeout from class and say, you notice what they did there in the book. Why'd they do that? The students should be able to tell you they believe in evolution. They don't believe God created the world. And those can be profitable times in a class. Things like the sanctity of life. We have a secular, we use globe series in teaching world cultures. We just finished a section on China in a class that I teach. And talking about Mao Zedong and China's population problem. We can springboard from that, China's one child per family policy, and we can go off into some little discussion of philosophy that is profitable for students. Now, they need to learn about Mao, they need to learn about China, but they need to learn about the sanctity of life too. And sometimes you can almost do that better with a secular text. You can say, look what they said here. Why'd they say that? And students will bang, 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 bang. We know why they said that. We know what they're thinking and what they're trying to get across there. And that can be good. Using secular text in your classroom, if you have to do that, that can highlight choices in study. And that's a term that I like, choices in study. I teach history. That's all I teach at school this current year, 2 history classes. Now, U.S. history is a big, broad subject. We split it in 2 parts. One year we study up to 1877, the next year we study after that. And even at that, giving it 2 years, there's so much material you're leaving out. You can't talk about everything. So I get the great privilege as a teacher in the summertime to sit down and decide, this is what we're going to talk about when we talk about U.S. history. We're going to talk about exploration. We're going to talk about settlement. When we talk about settlement, we're going to talk about the Jamestown colony versus the Plymouth colony. And we're going to talk about pilgrims versus Puritans. 2 types of mind frames there. I can choose what I'm going to study about, and I can choose what my students are going to study about, even if I use a secular text. I have that power as a teacher, the choice of study. What we are going to talk about in class, that's up to me. That's the next point. Selection of material. Okay, you've selected your text, or maybe that's been done for you. You've selected Christian materials for some classes. You've selected secular texts for other classes. Now, what material within the textbook are you going to cover? Perhaps going into it, if you're new to teaching, you think, well, you cover everything that's in the book. If you're not new to teaching, you know that's certainly not true. You don't cover everything that's in the book. Some classes, you never get to the end of the book. Some classes, you do get to the end of the book because you skip chapters 7 and 8 and 14. You have choices in study, what your students are going to study. When you make your choices, what are students going to study in my class? You can build character by calling attention to the fingerprints of God. God's fingerprints are all over everything that we study at school, not just Bible class. God's fingerprints are all over science. His fingerprints are all over math. You can even say, in a general sense, his fingerprints are over the order and structure that appears in language. There's order in math. In the mathematical world, an order that maybe escapes us in other aspects. I believe God put that there. There's order, complexity, and wisdom in science. And whose is it? Is it man's? No, it's God's. And you can call attention to that. In choosing what you study, you can highlight that for students. Look at this. How many of you get National Geographic at your school? Probably quite a number of you, or you get it at home. A month or so ago, they had a cover picture of a beetle on it. Just a beetle, a close-up of a beetle. I don't remember what kind of beetle it was. And it's amazing to look at that creature up close. I'm not a science person. I don't know a lot about science. But that particular beetle they put on the cover is an amazing creature. It looks like it's armored and spikes coming off of its head. That's God. God put time into that little beetle. God made that little beetle just the way he wanted to make it. And how long has it been since we noticed something like that? If you're a teacher, you have the great advantage of being able to achieve your goal, building character in students by pointing to God in just about everything that you teach. You can call attention to desirable characteristics, things that you want your children, you want your young people to emulate. Again, I'm going to refer to history. That's kind of what I know, so that's what I'll talk about. We studied U.S. history this year. We're in the first part of U.S. history, from the beginnings up through 1877. And when I made my scope and sequence at the beginning of the year, what we're going to study and the order we're going to study it in, I put in focus studies, three focus studies on individuals. We come to George Washington in the curriculum. We're going to kind of drop U.S. history, and we're going to look at George Washington just as a person. We're going to study George Washington. We're going to stop again and study Benjamin Franklin. And now we're progressing along our way, and when we get up toward the time of the Civil War, we're going to stop, and we're going to just focus in on Abraham Lincoln. And we're going to look at those people. Not because they were Christians. I don't believe any one of those three were a Christian, as far as we can tell from what they wrote or the actions in their lives. But they did have some very admirable character qualities about them that we can hold up and ask students to emulate. George Washington, he was a man of integrity. We studied about Valley Forge. The reason the American Army held together at Valley Forge in that terrible winter wasn't because they really believed they were going to win. It wasn't because the war was going well. It wasn't going well. It wasn't because they were getting good support from the Continental Congress. They were not getting good support from the Continental Congress. It wasn't because they were being supported by the common people. They lived in a region, a rich farming region, and the local farmers, Mennonites included, took their produce to Philadelphia because the British would pay, and the Americans, they had to buy on credit. So they wouldn't feed them. They would take it to Philadelphia and feed the British. So there they are in dismal, discouraging circumstances, and a lot of them left, but there was a core, the core of the Continental Army that did not leave. And why didn't they leave? Because George Washington stayed there, and they believed in George Washington. So long as he stayed, they were staying. If he left, they would all leave too. He was a man of integrity. They trusted him. Benjamin Franklin, you can point out the admirable character qualities, his work ethic, common sense. Abraham Lincoln, honesty and humility. And as a teacher, you want to build character qualities in young people. You want to develop them gradually over time. You can hold up these people and point out the admirable parts of their life, not ignoring the rest, but say, this is something that is worth emulating. Here is an area where this person followed God's principles, and look at the success it brought in that person's life. You can call attention to roots of destruction. This is also perhaps easy to do in teaching history. You're studying the Roman Empire. Talk about indulgence and self-satisfaction. What brought down the Roman Empire? You talk about American history, you can talk about Richard Nixon. What brought Richard Nixon down? The fact that he did illegal things? Not really. He was brought down from his position of power because he lied. He was a liar, and he tried to cover things up, and it destroyed him. Dishonesty destroys you. You can teach that to young people. You can slip into current affairs. Regardless of what Bill Clinton did or didn't do, he has the stigma of immorality hanging over his head. Perhaps he's going to beat the charges. Perhaps nothing's going to come of it. It doesn't matter. The price is already paid. What did Bill Clinton want to be in life? He wanted to be John F. Kennedy. That's what he wanted. I believe from a young person on, he wanted to have a place in American history. He wanted to be loved. He wanted to be written about in nice ways in the history books. That dream is ruined, and I believe he knows it, and I believe Bill Clinton will die a bitter man because he is stained with immorality now. Whether it's proven true or not, the stain is there. That his own actions provided a seed for destruction. That's something we can highlight to students and point it out. Okay, we selected our text. We selected the particular material within the text that we're going to present and talk about. We selected enrichment assignments. Now, we can steer students to wholesome materials. Make lists. Hold up a book and say, by the way, we're talking about such and such. We've only got one day to talk about it here in class. But if you're interested in learning more, this is a good book for you to read. You can come see me. 20 out of the students, 19 out of the 20, you'll never see them. There might be one that comes and says, hey, could I borrow that book? And you're providing good enrichment materials there for the student. Create pockets of expertise, retain knowledge for the students. We're studying about American history. I'm going to make up a list, and you can come and choose off the list. You have to do a self-study project on this little topic and become an expert on it. Be able to tell the class a lot about XYZ. And there's profit in that. Let's quickly go to structure. Now, we said structure is the way that a school is run in general. And there are probably more elements here than I'm going to be able to talk about. I've just selected some. Accountability is a big one. Is accountability taught in your school? Are students accountable in your school? Are they accountable for actions? Are they accountable for their words? Being respectful, not just to their authorities, but to the peers that they have. Are students accountable for the attitudes? They turn in their assignments. They don't say anything wrong, but there's a wrong attitude there. Are they held accountable for it, or is it they turned in their assignment, they didn't say anything wrong, and the rest just kind of slides by? No, we need to hold them accountable for their actions. We need to hold them accountable for their words. We need to hold them accountable for their attitudes. What about teachers? We talked a lot about students being accountable. Teachers accountable in a class, in a school setting? They sure are. If the teachers aren't accountable, if they don't live up to their accountability, that makes it pretty hard for the students. A teacher is accountable to perform to the best of their ability, to do the very best they can, to apply themselves in their own study for class. A teacher is accountable to increase their ability, to be able to teach more next year than they taught this year, to be able to teach the same class next year better than they taught it this year, to improve themselves along the way. We expect students to improve their performance from year to year. Do you as a teacher, do you strive to improve your performance next year as opposed to what it was this year? Teachers are accountable to respect authority, not just the school authority. How do you speak about parents within the hearing of your children? How do you speak about the parents outside of the hearing of the children to another teacher? How do you speak about church leaders? We, in our school, we're a patron school. It means there's several different churches available. And in my younger years, I don't think I was known for being a person who held my tongue. Sometimes in a school setting, you need to hold your tongue. People don't see everything the same way. You're there to educate. That's the part of that child's life that's given to you, instruction, spiritual as well as academic. Perhaps the child comes from a different church background. Perhaps they practice things a little differently in your home. There are times when you must learn to hold your tongue if you're going to be accountable and teach the children. You need to be accountable to parents. You communicate with the parents. You're supposed to be there in the place of the parents. You keep the parents informed when things are going along, or does the first inkling a parent has of problems is when the detention notice goes home, or the principal calls and says, so-and-so's in the office, and we're probably going to be paddling the child unless you're able to come in and do it for us. parents should have known a while before that if anything was going wrong at school. You're accountable to the parents for providing information and for providing moral and physical safety for that child while he's under your care. If you're accountable, you can help children build accountability in their own life if they see it in you. Are you accountable to students? I think teachers sometimes slip in this area. We can be accountable to parents. We can be accountable to our school authority. And the students, they're accountable to us. We have an accountability that goes the other way, too, to students. I think we're accountable for scope and sequence, letting students know what's kind of expected academically. What's the scope of our discussions this year in class? What are we going to be talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about everything from here to here. And in what order are we going to be talking about them? We're going to talk about this first. And then just so that you know what's happening, when we're done with this, then we're going to talk about this. And then we're going to be able to understand this other area, okay? So that going through the year, maybe the student even has it a page in their notebook. I can see Mr. Lauer right now. We are talking about the panic of 1819 or 37, whichever it was. And I see where we're going. We're going to be talking about slavery pretty soon. And then we're going to be talking about the Civil War. And we're going to talk about Abraham Lincoln. I think you're being accountable to your students when you do that. You're keeping them informed about what's going on in class. And that builds an accountability on their part where they can keep other people informed about what's going on in their life. Equitable grading systems that are fair to students, that are fair to disadvantaged students. Well-defined expectations and rules. The students should know what to expect out of a teacher. Miss Nolte, she wants her papers to look a certain way. There's no doubt about it. We know what she wants. Getting ready for recess or eating lunch at our desk, we know exactly what's allowed, and we know exactly what is not allowed. There's no surprises here. After about the first week or two of school, things were explained, things were reinforced, things were stood behind. And the students know what the expectations are. That's a comfortable place to be when you know what the expectations are. That helps the child to build respect for that teacher, respect for authority in general, if things are laid out in an orderly way and things are not made up as the teacher goes along. Teachers need to respect other staff members at school. They have to have respect for schedules. This is something that we work on at school, and I think we do a pretty good job in high school. Students transfer from teacher to teacher. I need to know. I need to discipline myself. I have to work at this. I'm not good at this. I'm teaching along. I'm excited about this, whatever it is I'm teaching about. I'm enthusiastic about it, but it's 1:26 and the bell rings at 1:29 and I have not yet given a homework assignment. I need to shut up. Wind it down, get my homework assignment on the board, so that when the bell rings, they've only got 2 minutes to get to Mr. Stolzfus's classroom, and Mr. Stolzfus, the things that he wants to talk about today are just as important as the things that I want to talk about. So I need to wind it down when it's time for me to wind it down. I need to respect other people's schedules. I can't be going dumping things on other teachers. Hey, can you do this favor for me? Can you do this favor for me? They've got all of their own things to do. Sometimes you do need help. But you got to be careful. You got to be accountable to other people. If students see you abusing other people's time, going way over, having a test, nope, no one's leaving till you're finished with the test, stay here, not going over and informing the other teacher, may I hold a few students for about 10 minutes or 5 minutes, that causes problems. I had to apologize to a teacher on Friday, a chorus teacher. A student came down. They had to take some sort of a standardized test. And they had study hall time, and they were doing it then. Fine, that's great. I started administering it to them, and all of a sudden I realized they have 2 hours to work on this test. Study hall only lasts for about 35 minutes. And if they stop before they're finished, all the unfinished answers are counted wrong against them. Oh, no, he's going to miss chorus. Well, I'll have to go talk to Mr. Stolzfus, and I didn't get it done. I forgot. And it just so happened Mr. Stolzfus also had about 10 students out finishing a biology test, and another teacher held a student out to finish an accounting test. And all of a sudden, Mr. Stolzfus, Dale Stolzfus, is trying to prepare for his chorus program, and half of his chorus, other teachers have them held hostage up in other parts of the school. We were not accountable. We had to go say, hey, we're sorry. We shouldn't have done that. You've got important things to do too. We should have thought a little bit further. Interpretations of rules. This comes up in a place like study hall. Some study hall teachers, by the book, you know, what are you working on there? Why are you reading the newspaper? Don't you have things to do? I looked down on the calendar down there, and you've got a test tomorrow in such and such a subject I saw. Oh, yes. But another teacher is having study hall, and the student comes in, and they can read the paper all period long. They can read a book. They can look out the window. The teacher never looked to see if they've got anything coming up on the calendar. Never went over and said, talking a little bit too loud. Now, those are extremes there. But, you know, we all got to be at the same place, generally speaking, as on things, on issues as teachers. Otherwise, we present conflicts for students, and we teach them to act one way in one place and another way in another place and not abide by a written guideline. Precision is important. Precision teaches students. You need to care about appearances as a teacher, as a school. You need to care about the way your building looks. You need to care about rooms, about halls, about materials. It's important. You teach more by those types of things sometimes, maybe, than what you teach in the classroom. We have staff meeting on Monday night, and one of the things I put on the agenda is chapel chairs. We have chapel down in the gym. We have elementary chapel, then we have high school chapel, and the teacher who's on gym duty in the morning when the students come in, they're supposed to set up chapel chairs on Tuesdays. And almost always, almost 100% of the time, they get set up. But when I go down for chapel, the chairs are all kind of strung along there. That's just something that kind of bothers me. You look down the back of the chairs, and all these things should be lined up like this. You know, in a straight line there. Because chapel is important. Chapel, important things happen at chapel. We just don't go and throw ourselves down in the chair in chapel. We need to do a better job of making... We're in the gym. The gym doesn't look the best. It's kind of dingy. But it's chapel. It's important. When we're going to set those chairs up anyway, let's make the back of the chairs line up. So when you come in, someone took some time setting these chairs up. Someone was careful. This must be something important that's going on here. And it is. Are you careful about little details about that? Do you help students to learn to groom themselves appropriately? There will always be some students, one in your classroom. They don't smell the best sometimes. Sometimes their clothes clash. It wouldn't have to be that way. You need a little bit of guidance along that way. And it can help build some good qualities in their life. You need to care about deadlines with students. You need to be firm. You need to teach them that deadlines count. If something's due, it is due. I heard a good thing the other day. It was between classes. I heard students talking, and two students were going by me, and the one student was saying to the other student, I'm going to ask Mr. So-and-so if we can change the deadline on such-and-such, whatever it was. I don't even particularly remember the subject. And the other student said, you already know the answer to that. That was real nice to hear that. They knew ahead what they were supposed to do. They knew what the deadline was. One of them evidently wasn't as far along as they should have been. They were going to see if they could get some leeway. And the other student right away said, you already know what the answer to that is. Okay? Someone's being firm there. Someone's setting a principle. You have to work. And you have to work in a timely manner. And they're going to stick to it. Or at least, I assume they stuck to it if the question was even asked. You need to care about written guidelines. School policy, school handbook, class rules that you wrote down at the beginning of the year, do they get thrown out about halfway through the first quarter? That doesn't help teach children good things about what's written down. You pay attention to what is written down. You need to pay attention in your school to service. That has to be something that's built into the structure of your school. You need to have planned opportunities for service for the students. Things like mission trips. We all take field trips. Do you take any mission trips? Turn some of your field trips into mission trips so that students learn that service, that's just an automatic. It's not something we do sometimes. That's just a built-in part of life. What about charitable activities that a class can participate in together? helping people who are less fortunate. Build that into your class, build that into your school structure, and students learn to love and respect other people. Personal assistance to other students. This is sometimes hard to do. You've got a student who's real bright, they're real hardworking. You want them to succeed in life, you want them to do well, so you just kind of pamper them and cater to them, and they're kind of your school star or your class star. They're going to do well, they're going to succeed in life. Maybe that particular student needs to be spoken to. You know, you do have special abilities, special talents, so I want you to spend more of your time, your free time, helping this other student over here who doesn't have the same abilities that you have. Okay, maybe give up a little bit of your goals and dreams in order to help the person along the way. That's part of Anabaptist education. My own personal success will be tempered by the needs of other people. And I need to have that built into me that, you know, I can study hard, and I know I'm going to get 98 on the test. If I spend two extra periods studying, I might be able to get that 100, but there's another student here who needs help. Am I willing to help that student if I'm asked to do it? We need to build in that acceptance of, yes, I do have a responsibility to help other people, and I'm willing to kind of lay aside myself and pick up and help the school or help that student who needs some assistance. Encouragement to serve, that needs to be built into your school. Announced opportunities, like on a bulletin board. Now, you know, we don't want our students running out of the high school and going into VS. I'm dropping out of 10th grade because they need me at such and such a boys camp to be a cook. No, but we're still going to put those opportunities there so that they see those, so that all along their way they're thinking, you know, VS, service, that's something you do when you're able to do it. I've got all these ideas coming at me. I'm learning about these different opportunities. I'm getting out of school next year. I'm going to do service somewhere. Do you present those opportunities in a regular way? Personal examples, teachers doing things of service to other people, motivational speakers like missionaries. And I don't mean to throw the burden. We want to motivate someone. We got to pull in a foreign missionary. We had a real neat opportunity at school. I think it was in January. One of our past graduates, quite a number of years ago, perhaps 10 years ago, is in full-time service in China, sort of on a voluntary basis. He's not getting paid to do this. He came back to our school and he talked about what he does working in China. That was great to have him there. Someone who came through our school and now they're serving the Lord full time and coming back and giving that encouragement to the other students that are there, that, hey, there's a needy world out there, and when you're out, you can do the same thing that I'm doing here. Of course, we build structure through discipline at school. We build discipline, I'm just going to speak in very general terms here, in two areas. We build discipline on respect and we build discipline on love. Students need to be taught at school to have respect for God. Not to tell God jokes, the capitalizing H in his when it talks to God, talks about God. Those are ways that we are building respect for God. Students need to, in the rules, whatever rules your school has, they need to learn respect for authority. They need to learn to respect their peers. You can't run Mr. Lauer down, and you can't run Mr. Grable down, but I can run Travis down if I want to. No, we have to learn that you have to respect not just your authorities, the ones that can do things to you, but your peers too, also. They need to learn to respect property at school. All of these things, over time, will gradually build qualities, character qualities in students. They need to learn the discipline system that you have at your school needs to be built on love so that students can sense that. They can see the value of the discipline. It has to be a love of righteousness. What does God say in this situation? Does God have anything to say about this? We need to listen to what God says. We need to love righteousness. We need to love the student. We need to do what's good for the student. This rule, let me explain it to you. You're having a difficulty here. You're in violation of this. Let me tell you why we have this rule and that this rule is intended for your own good. And I will take the time to explain that to you. We're trying to build qualities, character qualities in our students. We're going to use our curriculum to do that. We're going to use our whole school structure to do that. And very quickly, we're going to use methods, personal methods, to do that too. What method can you institute in your classroom? Predictability. Teachers need to be predictable people. Your expectations need to be predictable. They need to know how you grade assignments. They need to know if you tell them to write an essay, how much are they supposed to write? And how broad is it supposed to be? There need to be predictable consequences in a classroom. If I do this, I know what the consequence is. It was announced ahead of time, and I've seen it consistently enforced from the first day of school to this point. There are consequences for the things you do in life. This was another thing I heard the other day. It was said about me, student to student. It was not intended as a compliment. To their chagrin, I told them it was a compliment. They had a quiz announced for that day. And they came in, and as students are, they were studying at the last minute, frantically trying to stuff information into their head. And I said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "You said there was going to be a quiz today." If I say there's going to be a quiz, there may have been a time when I didn't have them, but I try to be consistent now. Maybe at one time I didn't always do that, but if I said there's going to be a quiz, you better prepare, because there's going to be a quiz. There might be quizzes sometimes when I don't say there are quizzes, too. But if I say it, then I want to follow through with it. That teaches them something about God. Doesn't he? When he requires something of someone. You need to be predictable in your attitude and demeanor. A teacher who's real happy one day and real sour the next day, or from minute to minute, that does not build any quality like steadfastness in a young person. Preparedness. You need to be prepared as a teacher. I'm sorry, I'm starting with the students first. The students need to be prepared. You need to prepare them. People need to be prepared for life. That's what character does for you. They need to know how to study. They need to know what to study. They need to know how to make wise use of their time. Those things do not come automatically. Those are things that you must teach them. Teachers must be prepared also. Teachers need to be prepared for class before class. I was a bad example of this the other day. I did not intend to be. I was prepared for class. Had my notes all made. Long time ahead of time. I had a study hall the period before the next class. It was World Cultures class. And I had a big stack of papers in my grade book. These weren't being graded. These were their suggestions for questions. We're taking this particular class to the Chinese embassy in D.C. because we're studying China, and that's going to kind of wrap it up. Talk to a spokesperson there and give and take, ask questions. I had solicited questions from the students. I had intended to compile these into a list and then go back over them with the students. I'm sitting there in study hall. I'm looking over my lessons for the next class. I've got about 30 minutes worth of material here. That class is 40 minutes long. I was going to spend 10 minutes reviewing. Instead, I'm going to quick compile those questions, and we'll go over those questions. There's a computer there in the study hall, so I did it there on the computer, but there's no printer in the study hall. What am I going to do now? So I borrow a disk off of someone, save it, and then the bell rings, and I've got 2 minutes before I'm supposed to be ready to start the next class. So I briskly walk to the next classroom. That teacher has a computer in his room with a printer. I pop my disk in. I start printing my material. The bell rings. I pull it out and tuck it in my book. You know, what did it look like? Mr. Lauer just finished his notes for class, and the bell rang. Now, it wasn't the case. But I didn't look very prepared there. That's not good. You should have the flexibility in your classroom of being prepared. How much easier is it when you're prepared? You can go into the classroom you can joke about Joe's shirt, you know, or talk to Tina about what she did last night. And you're not up there trying to get ready for class. Time to start. Okay, it's time to start. Open the book. Bang, bang, bang. There you go. You need to be prepared. You expect your students to be prepared. Shouldn't expect anything of them you don't expect of yourself. Are you as a teacher able to compartmentalize things, to break things down into different segments? This is something that we need to teach children to do. Relationships with other people, okay? Maybe in a particular class, you did not get along so well with a certain student in that subject. They had difficulty. They were kind of stubborn. You go into the next class, the next subject. Do you carry that kind of burden up on your shoulder? He's kind of difficult here. I'm going to have a difficult time with him too in this class. Or are you able to kind of put that away and deal with this class independent of the other class? Now, of course, there are some circumstances there we got to carry things over, but can you compartmentalize? If you can compartmentalize, you can control your classroom, and we need to teach that to our children. There was a perfect example of this. I still don't know how this teacher did this. This was about 2 weeks ago. A teacher was teaching in her class, and the phone rang, and I answered it. It was her sister. She wanted to talk to her sister, the teacher. So, okay, I went up and checked, and yeah, in the class, she could have been disrupted right at that moment. So I got her. She went down, talked on the phone. Was down there for a couple minutes. Came back up, and I swapped places with her, and on her way past, she said, I'm going to need a substitute at the end of the period. I said, okay. She looked a little bit upset. She was in a hurry to get back to the classroom. I was in a hurry to find a substitute to arrange something to cover her classes for the rest of the day. She just found out her father died unexpectedly. What did she do? She went back in her classroom. Okay, we're on page 27. Any questions about that homework or whatever it was, she said. She gave them their homework, said, a number 17 on this page, that's kind of a difficult problem. If you've got a difficulty, refer back to the theorem on page so-and-so. She compartmentalized. Her father was dead. She just found out about it. She had 10 minutes of math class to go. She put that aside. And she's an emotional person. She's not one of these stoic people that could see someone murdered in front of her and, that's terrible. No, she's an emotional person, but she compartmentalized it. I have a responsibility here to finish this class. They're going to get me a substitute for the next period, but I'm going to finish this class. I believe she walked out of there without those students knowing anything was wrong. She's an amazing lady. I really appreciated her ability to do that, not to fall to pieces. That teaches something to students, if you can do something like that. If you can handle the difficulties life throws their way, the little difficulties that come up in a classroom, you should certainly be able to handle those. Not lose your temper, not fly off the handle, not break down and lose control. You need to be able to do those types of things. You need to know your student. You need to know your student's personal characteristics, their family situation, their academic records. You need to be able to be close to your students. Not much worse than a situation where you walk into a room in between classes or at the end of the day or beginning of the day or lunchtime, and the teacher's up here and all the students are way over there. They don't really care to be around that person. They don't like to be close to that person. You like instead, you walk into, Kim Stalsus is a fellow who teaches at our school. You walk into Mr. Stalsus's classroom and he's here at his desk or he's over here at the table working and the students are just about kind of hanging off of him. Okay? He knows them pretty well. He relates to them on a very personal level. They love Mr. Stalsus. They will be receptive to what Mr. Stalsus wants to teach them. Are you that way as a teacher? What about use of Scripture? This is something that needs to be part of your method as a teacher. Scripture needs to be used for general inspiration and atmosphere in your classroom. You know, the bulletin board, the Scripture verse, and the nice pictures. Starting off the class and maybe just sharing, hey, my devotions this morning, I came across this verse. It's kind of special to me. It doesn't have anything to do with English, but I just want to share it with you, and then we'll get on with our work. Types of general atmosphere that you create in your classroom, that's real important. And then being specific, that's doing it in a general sense, but being very specific, narrowing it down, linking specific events, facts, and characteristics to scriptural principles. I started this year in our teacher memo. Occasionally I'll ask the question, do you plan to refer to Scripture in a class you're teaching today other than Bible? And I ask that question to myself. The answer isn't always yes. And what a shame. We have the privilege of having a Christian school. I have the privilege of teaching history. I have choices in study. I choose what we're going to talk about today in history class. And I'm going to go all period long, and not even tie in what I'm talking about with Scripture. Okay, I get to talk about slavery today, the institution of slavery. And I don't take the time to do a little scriptural research and bring in what God says about this or some general principles that can guide our discussion here. Do I take the time even just to refer to Scripture in my classes other than Bible? If you're a Christian school teacher, you should be doing that. You should be teaching your students to make Scripture a part of everything they do. There's almost always some Scripture verse or principle that's applicable to your situation. We might know it in our head. We might kind of think about it a little bit. But do we actually bring it out and link it? Do we say something, but then do we say, but you know what? God says that. Okay? It's one thing if I say it. I'm Mr. Lauer. I make mistakes. I say things wrong. I say dates wrong. I say the wrong president for such and such. And I have to go back and say, oh, no, that was wrong. I meant so-and-so instead. But when I say certain things, and these are the things that are really important, can I quickly say, you know, God said this. It's in such and such a chapter and such a verse. God said that. Link specific things they need to learn to something that God said. I like this statement. This comes from John Hostetler's book, Children in Amish Society. Talking about an Amish teacher, and we're just going to assume he's saying any teacher there, a Mennonite teacher. The Amish teacher must teach with his whole life. You must teach with your whole life, with everything you do, with the book you set down in front of a student, with the materials, the extra materials you prepare for your class, with the general structure that you build in your classroom, that you help build at your school. Are you teaching about Jesus? With the methods that you use in your classroom. All of these things that we talked about, they are not profound. They are everyday types of things, common types of things that we encounter, but that's our goal. We need to teach. We want to develop a context for character development. We want to create or expand gradually over time a situation or a set of circumstances in our classroom that will gradually over time lead to the development of personal moral qualities there, Christian qualities in young people.
Sit and talk shop, as they say, for a while.
Questions about talks today or anything else that you might just want to bounce off of somebody? Feel free to bring it up. Just affirm what Richie said there about having a difficult topic. Did very well with it, covering a broad range of things that really address a number of areas that need to be thought about. Any questions or discussion?
Mention of mission trips and charitable activities. What are some suggestions?
Okay. He talked about, you talked about missions and charitable activities. Do you have anything that you do or any ideas?
At our school, our 11th and 12th graders are together on their mission trip and on their senior trip. They have a senior trip every year, but the 11th and the 12th graders go. Both groups contribute to raising the money for it. And we, at our school, we alternate by the year. We have an international trip a cross-cultural trip, and then more, I guess you'd say, a localized trip. But the mission, the 11th and 12th grade trip always has a mission emphasis. They're going to do something at some mission. They're going to include some mission activity. It's not a high school trip, a senior trip that's for fun. one last blast before you separate and go your different ways. And you can do things in a regular pattern. We used to do it at Haiti on our cross-cultural year and work with one of the missions there. But then when the political troubles were in Haiti, that switched. They had a real great opportunity, I think it was 3 years ago, they went to Romania. Probably won't be able to do that again for a while. That cost quite a bit. This year they're going back down to Mexico. They've been to Mexico once before, working with the Mennonite mission, doing service work while they're there. This requires a lot of, to do something like this, it requires a commitment on your part that that's important to your school to do it, because it costs to do those types of things. It takes lots of fundraisers. It takes parents kicking in money to support this trip. We've got 18 students and a sponsor, two sponsors, going to Mexico, and I think the budget for that trip is something like $7,000. That's above and beyond all normal school costs. They raise that through extra fundraisers. If you're going to have extra fundraisers, that means students are going to be away from home, they're going to be taken away from milking or whatever at home. You better make sure you have the support of your parents to do something like that. But then it does make a difference. Yes, we've been on a class trip. It's a little more memorable. Yes, we've been on a class trip. We went to Mexico and we did mission work. The ones that were fortunate enough to raise enough money, they went to Romania. That's going to stick with them for a long time. We went to Romania and we worked in the orphanage. We went to Romania and we helped on the farm. And that's going to mean a lot to them. They help where they're going, but it helps them more than it helps people they went to help.
How long are those trips?
In Mexico, young people are going to be gone for, I think they're going to be gone 8 days.
Anthony, you had your hand up.
I was an apology for missing the last note. I guess I was glad to get done. But it was an important one that I just wanted to mention briefly. E, on the last page, engage some for the perfecting of the saints. Vulnerability, accountability, mentoring is so extremely important. I believe one of the tests of how sincere we are to change is how willing are we to be open to someone and share our stories. Ask for their first and humble ourselves for that point. So I just wanted to mention that Ephesians 4 makes that very clear. He gave some apostles and so forth. It says, for the perfecting of the saints, and until we all grow up in Christ. I believe that is another challenge. I think it's one that is a must in our space.
Thank you.
On a smaller scale of what Richie was talking about, on the service thing, we always are careful if a student had opportunity to go with their parents to Haiti, let's say, or something like that, to be quite obedient about the attendance policy than what we would have been, let's say, if they were going to Disney World. Everybody said, well, I'm not so sure if that's something we want to let show off the school. But it's a question of, here's a mission opportunity, here's a service opportunity. Or back in our area, CAM, this is when I was living in Chambersburg, CAM is just up the street, not up the street, but up the highway, about 50, 60 miles. So I guess more than that, 2 hours. And that was a lot easier to articulate for just a day or an evening or whenever it was a possibility. So it seemed to me that maybe schools could be more diligent in targeting that type of thing to encourage character in their use of service.
Friends, I might mention some more suggestions if you're thinking about instituting missions focus in your school. We do a whole high school mission project every year, too. And this is varied. There's all kinds of things you can do. We've gone down to Belleville, where the MCC is there to back meet. We don't necessarily support MCC, but that meet goes to a lot of different Mennonite missions that we would support. That's something they can go and give their day working there, packing meat, or go to CAM, like Melvin said. One we're thinking about for this spring is just staying real close to home with the whole high school, but splitting up into groups. And we have some widows in our patron body. and going to their places in the spring and just doing just the general yard cleanup and those types of things. Just to implant the idea, this is just something you do. You do this type of service on your day.
Those are good ideas. Anyone else?
I wrote a little statement here while Anthony was speaking. God wants change in me, and my students a great deal more than I wanted myself. I mean, with a face or a frown, I mean, this is a problem. We just kind of like it. That's why he was talking about this change thing. I'm thinking about all the resistance that we mount up to this. No wonder our characters don't develop much. They stay small.
I think the work that we as teachers, when we're called to that position, are willing to do what we've asked our students to do if the code comes to that. Several years ago, I was teaching a Sunday school class, and I had some boys were kind of rowdy. Okay? The next one gets out of hand is to write a Sunday school lesson and not for next Sunday. I never wrote the next Sunday school lesson. Just so happened there were several verses there, and one of the students, all the rest of the students took care of their responsibility. One student comes to me and no lesson. The next student, no lesson. So I went to his dad. My dad said, that's kind of a long lesson. I said, well, the rest of the fellows that got in trouble did it. Didn't say anymore. The next week, the next Sunday morning, I presented the father with the 10 copies of the Sunday school lesson, verse for verse. And the next week, son had paper in my hand. So if we're willing to show that we're willing to do the work that we ask, you know, even though it may cost on our part, I believe it's going to speak not only to the student, but to the parents. They're going to say, you know, there's more to this life than just fooling around and trying to be away from it. There's more to life than that. We are willing to present an image of Christ to people, and that's where the image is important. That's the important part of our life. What are we telling people about God? I mean, that's what he did for us.
Yeah.
Recently, it really come home to me, one of the recent lessons we had. All the work that Jesus did, that I was able to have people spit my face, pull my hair, beat me. Everything Jesus went through and died, it would avail me nothing, or anyone else nothing. But he said, I'm going to do it for you. He came to this example of a perfect teacher. And I'm sure it wasn't easy.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? How many students do you have in your school?
117.
How long have you been there?
2 years this time. Like I said before, I'm a teacher.
Oh, okay. Were a lot of these things you're talking about in place in your school? How long has your school been?
This is our 26th year.
How many of you teach in schools that are 5 years old or younger? Maybe. How about 10? 10 years. How about 15? Anybody 20? Still have that. Still have Mary Martha there. Okay. It takes a long time to build at the point where you can do all of these things really well. At least that's my experience. Just takes, like he said, just affirm what he said, that if you can take one or two things, go home, put them to use, you'll be doing well. The main thing is you keep working, you have a list that you're going to work off of for next year.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.